What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar.
Josh, don't treat him that way.
Why not?
It's humiliating.
The way I was humiliated by all of you, you led me around on a leash.
That was different. We thought you were inferior.
Now you know better.
I feel chastened, Josh. I have treated franchise reboots as an inferior species of movie.
I'm glad you've seen the error of your ways.
This week on the show, we'll check in on the damn dirty apes of Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, the sequel to 2011's surprisingly successful and surprisingly good Apes reboot.
Plus, our top five actors of the future.
Never trust anybody over 30.
Or humans. Ahead on Film Spotting. This episode of Film Spotting is brought to you by Audible.com, a leading provider of audiobooks with more than 150,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. To download a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/film. That's audiblepodcast.com/film. Later in the show, we'll offer up some audiobook recommendations.
We're also presented by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website, portfolio, or online store. For a free trial and 10% off, go to squarespace.com and use the offer code FILM. And if you want to check out a couple of listener websites that were created using the Squarespace platform, Owen in London sent us his URL, Josh, smokescreenlondon.com. He says it's for those who want to watch films in unique, hard-to-reach, or just plain weird places, such as rooftops or rediscovered underground temples. Smokescreen keeps an eye on not only the latest releases across London with reviews and interview features with the directors and actors, but we aim to keep our readers in the loop on the kind of intriguing one-off film seasons and special events that any card-carrying film buff would be ashamed to miss. Sounds like a valuable resource. We have a lot of listeners in the London area. Again, that's smokescreenlondon.com. And we got a link as well, Josh, from Zach in Nashville. He is an actor and director. This is his personal slash professional website. It's zachactdirect.com. We'll link to both of those in our show notes. Squarespace, we've touted them a lot over the years here on the show. They're constantly improving their platform with new features, new designs, and even better support. Every design automatically includes a mobile experience, which is great. And they've got the Squarespace Metric app for iPhone and iPad, which you can check and get your stats up to the minute, including unique visitors and your social media follows. And it all starts at just $8 a month, which includes a free domain name if you sign up for a year.
You can start a trial with no credit card required and start building your website. When you decide to sign up for Squarespace, make sure to use the offer code FILM to get 10% off and to show your support for Film Spotting. Squarespace, everything you need to create an exceptional website.
You're listening to Film Spotting. Matt O'Leary, Anna Maria Marinka, just two of the actors I once confidently named as actors of the future. This week's top five has us looking again for the stars of tomorrow, as we'll name our class of 2014 actors of the future.
Just remember, though, Adam, you did name Channing Tatum on that list, too.
That's true, but I also made you say that.
Yes, you did.
Plus, Josh will share some thoughts on the recent release starring Melissa McCarthy, Tammy. That's later in the show.
But first, what's the difference between apes and monkeys, Adam?
I got nothing.
Apes don't have tails, and they're generally larger than monkeys. And in Hollywood, they get all the good scripts.
Apes do not want war!
You know the scary thing about them? They don't need power. Lights, heat, nothing. That's their advantage. That's what makes them stronger.
We both have families. You want to protect yours. I want to protect mine. It's our only chance for peace.
Are you aware?
No!
They are going to turn on you.
They're animals!
There's an easy way and a hard way to get into this review of Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, Adam. The easy way would be to point out that as I came out of the screening tonight, not too long ago, went to the parking garage to get into my car, I found you wandering about in a daze because you had lost your car. And I could simply ask, was that because you were overawed by the awesomeness of Dawn of the Planet of the Apes? And just leave it at that.
Maybe.
But we'll go with the hard way.
Okay.
And that's to bring up the fact that we've been talking about Shakespeare here and there on the show the last couple of weeks. And I think it started with our Sacred Cow review of My Own Private Idaho, I believe, which draws pretty much from Shakespeare's Henry V. And we also talked about it just last week when we listed our top five films of 1989. You had Kenneth Branagh's Henry V on your list. In the original, well, the original of the reboot, Rise of the Planet of the Apes, John Lithgow names the main ape character Caesar because he's been reading Julius Caesar by Shakespeare. So an obvious allusion there. I don't know that they played it up much more than that in Rise of the Planet of the Apes.
Other than it being a leader.
Yeah, that it comes to the end probably is mm-hmm. where it really starts to be a more dominant theme.
I also notice here he has the Caesar haircut.
Who gives an ape a haircut?
I don't know.
I didn't see that in the civilization they were building, the barber shop.
He's more than an ape, Josh.
A missing detail. Well, in Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, it really comes to the fore here. And we should probably note, I am not schooled in all of the other apes films, but I do know that there is an earlier character in the franchise named Caesar as well. So this is something that's touched on. It's not completely new here in Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. But I thought it was really the backbone of this film. Julius Caesar, particularly, though it's not a scene-by-scene remake, there is definitely some palace intrigue, political intrigue going on here. That's really the crux of the movie. And there's another ape figure, Koba, who does feature in Rise of the Planet of the Apes as well. He's the one with the scar and the really nasty eye, the mean one. He has a much bigger part here, essentially playing Brutus from Julius Caesar. Now, the film, I thought, does this pretty well in its own way. I will grant you that the Shakespearean poetry, the language is missing. I mean, these apes, they're talking, but they're not quite up to Elizabethan language yet. It's a little bit more stilted. So I know that's not what would have hooked you, because you do love the language of Shakespeare. That wasn't here. Was there any visual poetry in Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, though, Adam, that made those connections with the themes that Shakespeare was going after in a way that justified this loose but cinematic adaptation?
Well, you said you were going to start the hard way, and you really did, because that's the one thing I haven't fully processed with this film yet. And I think, you know, we have Sacred Cow reviews on this show. We should also have these still processing reviews where we have just come from the movie.
Like
it hasn't happened in a while. But this is a case, in fairness, where not that it isn't a movie that isn't smart, but there's probably not a whole lot to process. This is an action movie. We've certainly had tougher tasks before. But that question about what Matt Reeves, the director previously of Cloverfield and Let Me In, the remake of the Swedish film Let the Right One In, that's the one thing I've still been thinking about a little bit, is whether or not he did enough visually beyond just the world building, his amazing use of close-ups, I think, throughout the film with humans and apes. And there is one bravura camera movement right near the end,
the tank,
where there's a battle scene and you get a moment where one of the apes gets on this tank as it's rotating around, and you get this full 360 shot that feels almost like something out of Emmanuel Lubezki in Children of Men.
It's Koba, actually, who's on the tank.
Yeah, it is Koba. It's the bad guy, and it's wondrous.
And the camera moves quite a bit during the action scenes in this picture in mm-hmm. ways that it doesn't always. Sometimes action films are content to just sit back and let it play out. One thing I liked here is how the camera is always moving, changing without a cut, mm-hmm. often to give us another vantage point.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. There is a real care and deliberation in how this film is shot. That said, the thing I'm thinking about is how many shots are really memorable? How many moments are there visually that really stand out? And maybe that's actually a good thing, Josh, because it isn't about fundamentally drawing attention to those camera shots. It's about the story, and it's about these characters, including the apes, very much so, including the apes, probably even more so than the men. They're
definitely
far more developed than the human characters are in this film. But I'm a little bit worried, Josh, because I was frantically trying to take some notes here as we came from the screening, and I'm sitting at Golden Joe Dassault's computer, and I swear to you, I just look up at the TV that's always on here at WBEZ, and it's on CNN, and the story on the screen is about a shark attack, a shark attacking a swimmer. And then the next thing, they have this whole big panel, the whole discussion is just about this. It's about bear attacks jogger, and it says, the title says, bears closer to residential areas. Josh, the war has begun.
You know what?
This movie's prophetic.
I want to be on the chimp side, because as we've seen, they can handle bears.
Yeah.
What an opening, huh?
Yeah, it is a really wonderful opening in this movie. And I think to get, though, to your main point, the crux of your setup there in terms of Shakespeare, I would say that you were sneaking a peek at my notes, except I have a feeling 99% of the people who go to this movie will be thinking about Shakespeare. I think it's unavoidable, and certainly I did as well. If there was a Caesar in the past of this series or not, I figured there probably was. At the same time, I think it's still worth saying now we really understand why they call him Caesar, why that character gets that name, because this is a Shakespearean action movie. You see the same frailties and foibles on display in both the humans and the apes that you're used to seeing in a Shakespearean drama, right down to the villain. We've mentioned Koba in this film. Yes, he's Brutus. That's probably the closest analogy, though maybe not quite as thoughtful as Brutus is in the text. But I'd put him on par with maybe the greatest villain in Shakespeare's writing, which is Iago, in terms of his shrewdness and his sense of integrity. He's not just an evil ape. He may go bad at some point.
You sympathize with his reasons.
You really do. He has reasons for what he does. They're valid. His fear is valid. And I think there are times where any of you who are watching this film, as much as you want to side with Caesar, he's set up as the hero, as the protagonist of this tale. There are times where you go, you know what? You're probably being too lenient with the humans. You probably are endangering your family and your home, those very things you're trying to protect, which is also what makes him, of course, a great Shakespearean figure, or a Greek figure more aptly. He's almost like Oedipus in that he kind of brings about his own downfall despite having, you know, the best intentions. So there's no doubt that that kind of Shakespearean intrigue is here. And it is something that I think does elevate this film beyond your usual summer fare.
Yeah, and we should probably point out that the actor doing the motion capture performance for Koba is Toby Kebbell. Not sure if I'm saying that correctly, but Andy Serkis has gotten all sorts of praise for his performance as Caesar, and he deserves it. He's fantastic again here. But as we've seen and who we're talking about mostly so far, Toby Kebbell deserves
some
praise
as well. He's a great actor. He's gotten some praise over the years on Film Spotting. He's been in movies like Control, the one about Joy Division, and he's been in other movies with Patty Considine. Very good actor.
And so that shows you that it takes traditional acting skills to make performances like this work. I agree with you. I think the richness, and maybe I agree more, I mean, it sounds like you're still processing it, but for me, the richness of the characters, even though they're allusions to Shakespearean figures, maybe not exact characters, it's still there for this story. So in other words, they're much more than references.
Right. No, they're not references.
They're taking those models and making that come alive. And one more thing about Koba that I'll throw in there as an example of this, you alluded to it. He gets a moment here where he just says two words. He's talking to Caesar, or they're using a lot of sign language. We should talk about how they use sign language in the film. But at this point, they're mostly using sign language, debating this. Should we work with these humans we've discovered are still alive, or should we attack them? And Caesar at one point says something about human work. They should cooperate towards the human work. Mm-hmm. And Koba just has this very sorrowful moment where he looks at him, says human work, those two words, and then points to one of his scars from when he was being experimented on in Rise of the Planet of the
Apes.
And
at first, when he says it, you almost think he's making a joke. I did anyway, that humans can't possibly work like we work. And then you realize when he emphasizes it, you realize
he
what he's pointing to.
A second scar and a third
much
scar.
Much more tragic and justified.
And there is maybe a way I will answer my own opening questions, in that we don't have the Shakespearean language, but we get a little bit of imagery to replace it, a little bit of cinema to kind of make up the gap in a certain way. And there are other images that stood out. One more of Koba later on, after he's begun to lead some apes against the humans. There's a great shot of him perched on this flagpole that's kind of tilted over, and it's a tattered American flag. And he's just kind of perched there very naturally, like an ape would. He didn't go out there, in other words, to make a statement. It just happens to be where he is. And humans underneath are being marched away by apes. And then one more, which comes with Jason Clarke, who's maybe the most sympathetic human figure. He was in Zero Dark Thirty. Serviceable here. He doesn't get as much screen time as the apes, but he works here. There's a scene where he and Caesar are talking to each other, and Caesar just brings their foreheads together, and we get this shot of them from their profile. Another beautiful image that gets at some of the themes going on. So for me, it did have that imagery to really back up, justify the Shakespearean references.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. Like I said, that's one of the things I'm still really thinking about. But at the same time, I really respect the way the film is shot. And I think ultimately, as I mentioned, it's in support of the characters more than anything. And you know me, this is one of the things when we're particularly reviewing mainstream films, maybe that aren't quite as distinctly artistic, and it's really about the story. You expect sort of a cause and effect chain of events, and you're following that. For me, when I do feel that absence of stakes, or when I feel like there are holes you can poke in what's going on and character motivations, that's when I start to tune out of movies often. Well, right. That never happens in this movie.
And it's a long movie.
The screenwriters, and Josh, maybe while I'm talking, you can look up their names because we haven't even gotten to that yet. But I'll give Matt Reeves, the director, credit. We'll certainly give the screenwriter or screenwriters credit for the fact that you understand in every single scene what every single character wants, what they're trying to achieve. It's all established with very little exposition. And without anything feeling like it's been shoehorned in just to set up a plot point later, there is a tremendous amount of care in setting up these worlds, the human world, this colony, and also the colony that the apes have formed. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I noticed, and maybe I've been watching a little too much Ozu recently in preparation for my upcoming Ebert class, but there is a lot of symmetry. And it's not so much visually, which is what you get with Ozu in terms of actual shots and compositions that might be here too, but where you really notice it is just in the way there's a balance between those human and ape worlds, and there's a juxtaposition that's always going on in this film. For example, as I said, in seeing how the apes are trying to set up a home and how important family is, and then we get the follow-up to that. We see on the human side what they're after, and establishing a home and taking care of their family is exactly what they're after. Each of our main heroes.
This is in the wake of a plague, we should know.
Exactly.
It's 10 years after the first film, and so there's been this plague that has wiped out a good chunk of humanity.
Right, and I did start to feel a little tense when we got the beginning of the film. The opening credit sequence is one of those, here's what you missed since the last movie ended
news
montages.
Footage,
and usually that sets a really bad tone for films.
I know.
Is the exception to the rule, though, and I'm not saying I love the opening credit sequence, but it certainly didn't detract from the film.
They do it artfully as well, using this globe image so that the newsreel footage is projected onto a map, and then you see the expansion
see
of the plague. So it's pretty creative.
Each of the heroes, the Jason Clark character and Caesar, they have a son, and each camp has a mistrusting, dangerous asshole in those camps. And I use that word because that's the word he himself uses to describe himself, and it is interesting that we get him in comparison to Koba, who's kind of the villain of that camp. And they have those same sort of fears that are driving their actions. So there is, and we could go on and on, there are a bunch of symmetries like that that just keep this whole movie really tightly strung together and really cohesive.
You know the scary thing about them? They don't need power. Lights. Heat. Nothing.
Hey, pal.
That's the advantage. That's what makes them stronger.
Malcolm, I'm thinking one of us should stand guard tonight.
Wait, what? They took our guns.
If they wanted us dead, we'd be dead already.
Maybe they're just taking their time. They already killed off half the planet already.
Come on.
What?
You can't honestly blame the apes.
Who the hell else am I gonna blame? It was a simian flu.
It was a virus created by scientists in a lab. The chimps they were testing on didn't really have a say in the matter.
Spare me the hippy-dippy bull. You telling me you don't get sick to your stomach at the sight of them? Huh?
You're exactly right about the symmetry. And one thing that I noticed is that both the apes and the humans share loss.
Mm-hmm.
They both had extreme losses in their past that are driving their motivations now. So that's another one. The screenplay credits on IMDb, at least, are Rick Jaffa, Amanda Silver, and Mark Bomback. And one of the things that they're able to do with these characters, and again, perhaps more strongly with the ape characters, is to make us emotionally invested in the personal outcomes, not only of Caesar, but also in Caesar's son, who's called Blue Eyes, and also in Maurice, I noticed. And here was a key moment when I realized how hooked I was. It happened to me in the first film, but you have to earn that back in a second film. It comes near the end, without giving away the details. Let's just say there's a showdown on a tower, and things are crashing about. And at one point, you're not sure. There's been a huge crash, and you're not sure what ape survived. And I realized that I could name at least three apes their actual names that instantly came to mind, like, I wonder where he is and if he's okay. I wonder if he is and he's okay. And that's, you know, maybe a simple measurement. But when you're talking about how far a film has to go to get us to buy in on these apes on screen, just visually, and then get that extra mile to get us to buy in emotionally, that's a huge achievement.
You're absolutely right. You're listening to Film Spotting. We're discussing the new film that opens this weekend in wide release, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. While we are praising the villain of this story, of course, it helps to not only have a really good villain, but you have an even better hero in Caesar and Andy Serkis's performance. And I wonder what you think, Josh, because obviously it sounds like you're pretty enamored with this film. And I think you even brought this up on past shows, this whole notion that people were discussing about at what point do some of these performances have to be discussed in terms of the Oscars or getting that kind of attention and those kind of accolades. And Serkis is even better here. The Caesar character in every way is more interesting in this film. And there's something deeper and more resonant and more expressive about Serkis's performance and what we see in that character of Caesar. And frankly, just watching him do anything on screen is exhilarating.
Yeah.
Whether it's dressing down someone like Koba or just giving a disapproving face to his son or riding a horse, being that leader on a horse, anything he does is pretty stirring. And I think that's a credit, obviously, to everybody involved, including Serkis, but also just the world that's been built here and our investment, as you said, in all of these characters.
Yeah, I think maybe the catch in wanting to go that far and talk about Oscars, and I was all for it with Rise of the Planet of the Apes. That was one of my favorite performances of the year. We'll see what else comes this year and how Andy Serkis's performance holds up here, or Toby Kebbell's for that matter. But I think one of the holdups for people is exactly what you mentioned. There's so much more involved in the performance. I mean, you talk about how makeup may enhance a performance. Mm-hmm. Here you have teams of animators. You're right. The expressions are huge that Caesar gives. How much of that is actual CGI and how much of it is Serkis's eyes or his facial expressions? It's hard to tell. It's hard to draw those lines. But he certainly can be credited for the gestures. And that's such a key in this performance, especially because the language here among the apes is still largely sign language. They don't speak to each other in words very often. I think that's one reason why we buy it, too, because they're not just sitting around chatting, right?
Right.
And it's an effort for them to talk. You can tell this is something they're still learning and working through. But Serkis's gestures, the way he'll reach out and just put his hand underneath one ape's chin when he's trying to get him to agree with him on a certain point, or when he'll puff himself up and try to take command and be that dominant figure. So all of that works. But the overall impression I get from Serkis in here is that he brings a weariness to this part that wasn't there in the first film. The first film, he's just trying to stay alive in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. And here, even though when the movie opens, they've established this colony, they're safe, they don't even think any humans are left alive, he still seems weary. He's burdened by this role that he's taken on. And here, maybe we're back a little bit, I don't know, to Prince Hal, perhaps. I mean, there are so many shades here you could go to. But I liked that touch. And both Rise of the Planet of the Apes and Dawn of the Planet of the Apes bring us to a point where this Caesar figure he's inherited a kingdom he never really was striving for.
Right.
And there's something touching and tragic about that.
Yeah, there is for sure. And I think what you say about him being burdened by his role is accurate, but I don't know if it's that so much, or at least that's how I read it so much, as the fact that I go back to a movie I love, and I know you're a fan of as well, like Take Shelter, where you know things are going to start to go really bad for Michael Shannon the second that he's sitting in the car with his best friend and his best friend says, "You've got such a great life. You've got a perfect life."
Yeah, right.
Right. It's one of the things where when you start to really appreciate, and in fact, that whole film is about that fear of the husband, of the father in that movie, worrying about whether or not he can maintain just what he has, not trying to get anything more than that, but simply maintaining and not let outside forces take any of that away or harm
it. That's sort of what they're setting up here.
And that's what they're setting up here in this film, is that now he is this leader, but he's also this husband and this father, and he has a newborn that we see his wife, I guess, give birth to.
Yeah, I was going to say that. I didn't notice I missed the barbershop and the marriage ceremony.
That's true. But there is that sense that he just wants to keep what he has going. And whether or not he feels like there's still humans out there, or he knows what the threat is. There is that weariness in him that you have to figure he wonders whether or not there is going to be some kind of external threat to this world they've created, because this utopia, and it is kind of a utopia, it's established that way, and you know it's going to go bad somehow if you've ever read Orwell, right? Because you go back to Animal Farm and the rules on the wall, four legs good, two legs bad. Well, our first shot of this colony we see is Maurice is teaching the kids,
ape
and there
school.
Are lessons.
There is a school.
Yeah, there is a school there, and it's about knowledge and how apes don't kill other apes. And as soon as they start to establish those kinds of rules, you do have a sense that, for lack of a better phrase, human nature is going to kick in at some point. And they are becoming more human as they take on those human traits. What this movie shows is that they can't deny that. And what it is mostly based on, of course, is it is based on fear. And I love how the movie gets into that. I think, like a lot of good sci-fi movies as well, it doesn't just tap into that fundamental aspect of human nature, but it reinforces it in scenes like the one where he says to his son, after his son has done something a little bit silly and didn't really mind his father, he says, think before you act. And it's such an obvious thing, but that is one of the obvious things that separates us from animals. It's not just the ability to think about larger, complex, philosophical, existential things, but just to think in those kind of terms.
To project to the future.
Yeah, to project to the future, to take that moment to make a decision before you just act on instinct. And I thought that was really fascinating.
You mentioned classic sci-fi, and that makes me think that this is a very earnest film in the way that some of those classics are. The original Apes movie is the one that I remember best. But also something like Star Trek, it has that sensibility in the way it is exploring these questions of human nature and motivation and such things. And I think that's maybe where the action helps out a lot, because, you know, Star Trek was never known for its action, but it would maybe, to me at least, talk these things to death a little bit. And here we get glimmers of it, and then things just bust open, and we get these really incredibly well done action scenes. So I like that balance that the film manages to achieve.
I agree with you. I think for me, if I'm going to end up having to hold this movie to a really high standard, and I think we should, because it earns it, absolutely. The one thing I found myself longing for a little bit more throughout was the lack of the sense of inevitability of everything. And I don't know if that's really avoidable with this second film in an installment like this in a series where certain things have to be put in place. But for example, I did, just before we sat down, I went back to look at my notes for Rise of the Planet of the Apes, and I wrote this, that the action scenes are really well staged and not just for action's sake. That applies here. The whole movie doesn't feel like a prelude to or an excuse for the violence and destruction. It culminates in it, feels like it's the only place it can go. That was one of the reasons I really liked Rise of the Planet of the Apes. Here, again, there's so much care in the characters and the world building that it wasn't a problem for me, but there was that part of me feeling like at some point I know that all these pieces and all this drama is in place so that we can get to war. It really is just about war. And that inevitability, I guess, took some of the surprise, and I just mean in terms of moments of surprise, not necessarily grand plot points, but just those moments that I look for in movies, I kind of felt like I knew where it was going, because that's the only place it could be.
Yeah, it's true you do know where it's going, but it takes a circuitous route for sure. And the steps that get you there are not strategic. They're political, as we mentioned, and they're emotional. There are some very emotional reasons why both Caesar and Koba make the decisions they make. So I guess it didn't bother me at that end. And there's something almost cool about knowing where something is going and then seeing those elements fall into place. I remember, as well as they do here, you're right. I remember in Rise of the Planet of the Apes, as it started to end, you could tell that this was setting up a whole new world of possibilities. And so often, quite often in some of the later Marvel films, when that happens, it's deflating. But in Rise, it just felt like, another world was opening in front of me. And I still had that feeling here. It's a little bit lessened in the ways you talk about, but I still had it.
Well, I know, because I follow you on Letterboxd, that you recently, in preparation, you're such a dutiful film critic, you rewatched Rise of the Planet of the Apes, still very much enjoyed it. And not that it matters at all, but would you say this movie's even better or about the same?
Yeah, hard to say because it doesn't have the newness. And it also had the higher expectations. I went into Rise
right.
ready to laugh.
Yeah, me too.
And so it's so hard to really compare the two on those terms.
But that does say it. The fact that you went in with such high expectations
yeah.
and it
No,
it
that's
met
a good
them.
Point.
I think it met them for me, absolutely.
Yep.
And I think just upon initial reflection, I think I might find it to be a better film. And the reason why is I can't really poke any holes in it at all besides that inevitability. And even that, as you said, there's a certain joy in seeing how everything is pieced together and comes together. But the big thing is I look back at my notes for Rise of the Planet of the Apes, and I don't know how many people would argue with me here. The science of it and some of the decisions that are made are so inane and so ridiculous that you get that it has to be that way. But you are moment to moment. I was anyway. Doubting what a lot of the characters were doing and why. The movie still pulled it off because the pace is so fast and the logic sort of holds up from scene to scene. It's a few scenes later before you realize, wait a second, that really doesn't make any sense at all. I had no such logic problems with this movie whatsoever, and maybe it's because it's not as sprawling. It didn't have as much work to do to set up this entire new franchise. But whatever it is, it is more self-contained, it is tighter, and maybe it is even better.
Maybe it's just that you don't buy James Franco as a scientist. I don't know. That could be it.
Could be. Could be. Toby Kebbell, by the way, I mentioned I knew he was in at least one film with Patty Considine. It's Dead Man's Shoes, a film directed by Shane Meadows. Very good movie. Toby Kebbell, very good in that film.
And perhaps a Best Supporting Actor nominee for 2014.
We will see. Dawn of the Planet of the Apes is out in wide release this weekend. If you see it and agree or disagree with our takes, you can email us feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also leave us a voicemail 312-264-0744. You have to do it in iambic pentameter. So a little bit of a tough task if you're going to leave us a voicemail. You can also find us on Twitter @filmspotting or facebook.com/filmspotting.
Apes was not one of the options we offered in our recent survey about the best movie of 2014 so far. Maybe it would have been a contender. Find out which film did win, however, when we reveal the results of the film spotting poll and more next. Stay with us.
Tap on the world and take a ride. I'll meet you on the other. Like the way I feel, every all around. You're around, guards nowhere to be found. Take a ride. I'll meet you on the other side.
Brief reminder here that this episode of Film Spotting is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website, portfolio, or online store. For a free trial and 10% off, go to squarespace.com and use offer code FILM.
We promise some audiobook recommendations later in the show, and that's what we're going to do now because we are brought to you by audible.com, a leading provider of audiobooks with more than 150,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. And I want to recommend three, actually, Josh. I've really gotten back into listening to audiobooks recently, which I do via the Audible app on my iPhone, and I just finished up the Roger Ebert memoir, Life Itself. I'd gotten to it a few months ago when I was planning my class, but I had about 10 or 12 chapters left, and it was a great way to finish that off listening to Edward Herman, the great actor, do the voice there on the Roger Ebert memoir. So we've recommended Life Itself before, but now that I've finished it, I can heartily recommend it. Also, Marc Maron, Attempting Normal, his book, been listening to that. If you love WTF, you'll probably enjoy Attempting Normal as I am. And I've also been alternating between The Marin and something very different than The Marin. Here and Now, it's a collection of letters between two very prominent authors Paul Auster, one of my favorite writers, and J.M. Coetzee, they just share letters with each other. They write about friendship, they write about sports, whatever it is. They actually send letters, Josh, handwritten or at least typed out, I'm guessing, versus email most of the time. And there's some great dialogue between them. So that's another one I can recommend here and now.
I'm assuming Maron does the Attempting Normal.
He does. Yeah. That is his voice as well. So it kind of feels like you're listening to the podcast. He actually brings a very conversational tone to it rather than it feeling like he's strictly reading. And I mentioned the Audible app. They do have free apps you can download and listen on your iPhone, Android, Windows Phone, Kindle Fire, plus iPod, and over 500 MP3 players. So again, that's how I listen to Audible. But however you choose to access Audible, they've got great stuff if you do enjoy listening to podcasts or other types of audio entertainment.
To download any of the books Adam mentioned for free or another one of your choice, just go to audiblepodcast.com/film. That's audiblepodcast.com/film.
Night from somewhere else. It's just a feeling. Doesn't make much sense.
Listen, you know all this bullshit we're talking about not seeing each other again? I don't want to do that.
I don't want to do that either.
You don't either?
I was waiting for you to say
this. Why didn't you say something?
I was afraid maybe you didn't want to see me.
All right, well, listen, what do you want to do?
Maybe we should meet here in 5 years or something.
All right, 5 years? 5 years, that's a long time.
It's awful. It's like a sociological experiment. How about 1 year?
1 year, all right. How about 6 months?
6 months?
Yeah.
It's gonna be freezing.
Yeah. Who cares? We come here, we go somewhere else.
Okay.
Those crazy kids and their sociological experiment. This is Film Spotting. That was Ethan Hawke's Jesse and Julie Delpy's Celine in 1995's Before Sunrise. Sunrise director Richard Linklater has charted Jesse and Celine's relationship over 20 years into additional films. Of course, 2004's Before Sunset and last year's Before Midnight. Linklater is back again this year with an even more ambitious movie experiment, Boyhood, which we haven't seen yet, but are dying to see it.
Tomorrow morning.
Oh, you're seeing it tomorrow morning?
Yeah.
I hate you. I can't make it to that screening.
Although, depending how late this goes.
We are here pretty late. Boyhood also features Ethan Hawke, and it's the story of a single boy's coming of age from 6 to 18, which Linklater filmed over 12 years. We're going to pit Linklater against one of his filmmaking peers and another one of my favorite directors in this week's Film Spotting Deathmatch poll. That's in a bit. Right now, though, we do have to plug. We only have a couple more weeks to plug this, Josh. Film Spotting number 500.
I know.
It's 3 weeks.
Yeah,
we're not remotely prepared, but it's coming up Saturday, July 26th. It's at the Music Box, the amazing Music Box Theater here in Chicago, 9:30 p.m.
My main concern at this point is if I can schedule a haircut between now and then.
Yeah, you need one.
I know.
You need one. I think I need to get one scheduled as well. All the information you need about purchasing a ticket for that event is available at filmspotting.net. And actually, we've been kicking around, even though we've talked about this and are sort of against reviewing new movies at a big live show like this. Boyhood feels like enough of an event. To us, it feels that way, and I think a lot of our listeners would agree, and it will have been out for a week, so people in attendance would have had a shot, would have had an opportunity to see it, in theory. By then, maybe Boyhood is a movie we should discuss at number 500.
That might be the way to go, though I'm still leaning towards, also, if Rian Johnson is able to make it, as he's planning to at this point, doing a Sacred Cow review with him of his choosing would be fantastic.
So I agree.
The problem with these live shows is there are so many things we want to and could do, but we can't be there for 12 hours. Probably could. You could. I might be able to do 8. You could do 12.
We did try that with our first live show.
I don't know if the audience could. So,
well, again, Film Spotting number 500. We hope to see many of you there. The info at filmspotting.net. Also at our website, there's information about, speaking of Shakespeare, Josh, as we discuss Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, July 27th, the day following our live show, number 500. I'm going to be appearing at Illinois Shakespeare down in Bloomington Normal, and myself and the artistic director of Illinois Shakespeare, Kevin Rich, are going to do a talk back after the 1:30 matinee showing of Much Ado About Nothing. And I'm excited to see the production, which I'm actually going to see this weekend. My wife and I are going down for that. And then again, on Sunday, July 27th, I'm going to be there for that talk back. We're going to talk about the Whedon version a little bit and just sort of updatings of Shakespeare in general. So if you're in the area at all, or even if you're just in Chicago, it's only a couple hour drive, you can meet us down there. And for Film Spotting listeners, there is a 10% off discount code on Ticketmaster for Illinois Shakespeare if you just use the code FILM.
While you're down there, see if you can find somebody who's seen Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, a Shakespeare expert, Kevin, maybe somebody else. Mm-hmm. See what they make of the comparisons, because they would probably know much more than I do.
I think we definitely have to bring it up. All that info about those tickets, again, also available at filmspotting.net.
Have you ever been questioned by the authorities?
Yes, on one occasion.
What?
I was arrested and tortured by the rebel militia after the desert uprising.
Right. Well, you know the drill then. Zip it.
Of course.
You never heard the word Van Hoytel in your life.
Got it.
Okay, let's go.
A scene there from Wes Anderson's Grand Budapest Hotel with Ralph Fiennes and Tony Revolori. A couple weeks back, we shared our top five films of 2014 so far. And so we asked you, what is the best film of the year so far? Your options were The Grand Budapest Hotel, which not only has gotten a lot of critical adoration, but was your number what, Josh?
It was my number
three or four.
I think it was four.
I couldn't believe it wasn't your number one.
Ida, Rover, yeah. Lego Movie is how I
okay.
went.
Okay. All the way down to number four, but we included it here, and apparently, as we're going to see in a second, for good reason, The Lego Movie, which was your number one, a candidate, my number one, Under the Skin, your third option, or if those three choices don't work for you, was it Other, an art house choice, or Other, a multiplex choice? And really, we were just curious there kind of how that shook out. Is this a year where a movie like Captain America or Godzilla was something that really stood out for you? We just wanted to separate them a little bit. Or was it something like Only Lovers Left Alive, the Jarmusch film we both had in our top fives? Was that the direction you were going? Josh, how did it come out?
Despite the fact that there have been, I think, some pretty well-received multiplex films, that was in last place with only 10% of the vote. The Lego Movie came after that with 16%. And the top three here, pretty tight. Under the Skin, 21% of the vote. Other art house option, 24% of the vote. But winning it was The Grand Budapest Hotel, 29%.
So there you go. The Wes Anderson movie getting almost a third of the vote. And I'd say, even in just restricting it to those three options there, those three specific choices we listed, we did all right, Josh, because only 34% went in another direction from those three choices. So two-thirds of our audience has seen those movies and thought they did rank among the best of the year, if not the best of the year. So I think we actually did okay with those options. Let's hear what the listeners thought. Trevor Wallace says, while I have to go for The Grand Budapest Hotel for its enthralling visual style and Ralph Fiennes' incredible dry wit and screen presence, I want to draw attention to a film I knew nothing about before I saw it, Snowpiercer. Creatively staged action, intriguing production design, and a plot that keeps you on your toes are all reasons I love the film. But most impressive was, despite how much of a true sci-fi action film this is, it is still the film that made me think the most about the world I live in and what it means to create a functional society.
And we will get a chance to say whether we agree with Trevor or not, because that's what we're reviewing next week's show.
That is our plan. The new film from director Bong Joon-ho.
We also heard from Jordan in Boston. The fact that The Immigrant, one of the few films released so far this year to be hailed as a masterpiece by some critics, isn't an option just shows how underappreciated this film is by both of you. You can have your little yellow figurines running around uttering tired meta jokes for 90 minutes, but I'll take Marion Cotillard and Joaquin Phoenix under the artful direction of one of the great American directors over The Lego Movie any day.
Well, I don't fundamentally agree with what Jordan had to say there, because it is true. We did not fully appreciate The Immigrant as much as many others did, including Jordan. But I do like that he got a little dig on you for your number one, Josh.
Let's let Kevin Lanigan weigh in and offer some defense for The Lego Movie. Have to extend my love to The Lego Movie on this one, because it works on so many different wonderful levels. Base level, it's hilarious with many wonderful characters. Structural level, the script and direction are top notch. Everything is well composed visually, and every moment in the film feels important, adding to either the story or the characters, or setting us up for something later on down the line, as the best script should. Artistic level, there's so much more here than anyone expected, and it continues to surprise on repeat viewings. There's the obvious comments on corporate-based consumer culture, but the film also comments on the artistic process and how artists whose views vary too much can never make something truly cohesive. The final plan that involves smuggling in brilliance through the guise of blending in with the controlled monotony is an incredibly clever comment on the film itself. The Lego Movie is it for me, hands down, at least until Paul Thomas Anderson graces us with his presence later this year.
That seems like sound reasoning, but of course Josh will inevitably put inherent vibe Vice in the bottom half of his top 10, and whatever Will Ferrell production comes out later in the year will be in his top 5. So
you never know. Anything can be great, Adam.
Ron Phelps says, no dirty, kinky Lars von Trier love. Nymphomaniac was one hell of an experience. Maybe that's where a lot of the art house lovers are going with it.
Yeah, I would like to have seen that vote broken down a little bit, because Nymphomaniac, I think... My guess is it would have fared better overall with audiences and critics if it was one film, because people tend to break between the two, and then, you know, it's tough to pick it as your favorite of the year.
I definitely have the first part of Nymphomaniac fairly high in my list of movies of the year. It's in the top 15, but really wasn't there in the top 10 as an honorable mention either. So another one I actually do want to go back and try to see before the end of the year. We close with David from Bonn, Germany. My vote, Pavel Pavlikovsky's Ida. Can't remember where I read this, but someone somewhere said that this film would have been considered a masterpiece in any era, and I wholeheartedly agree. The cinematography alone is breathtaking enough. Add to this two utterly charming and original female lead performances, and Pavlikovsky's obviously masterful sense of character and storytelling, not to mention the terrifically effective soundtrack of all diegetic music, and you've got yourself a pretty unforgettable cinematic experience.
That's a good case.
It is, but 5 days later, we heard from David in Bonn one more time, and he now said, forget everything I just said, Boyhood.
Did I mention I'm getting to see it tomorrow morning?
Yeah, you've mentioned that. Thank you, Josh. That's very kind of you. So some of the art house choices there from our listeners, and I do really like David's note about the music in Ida being all diegetic. In other words, all emanating from the movie world, because
the jazz,
I have to admit,
is so great in it.
The jazz is great, but all the music you hear, I don't know if it's just exclusively the jazz or not. I remember watching the film and being aware of the fact, because you're usually aware watching a film if the music is coming from the world or if it's coming from someone imposing it later in post-production. But it didn't occur to me that all the music in the film was diegetic, and that's the only sound that was used.
I do wonder about the final scene, because something, I'd have to look back in my notes, but I think it was that scene where I had that question myself. I did note, wow, this is all coming from something, action on screen. But she's walking along. Perhaps the music is coming from a car radio?
Maybe.
Could be.
Because
I think
there is music there, and she is all alone in the middle of nowhere. So.
Right. So okay. We'd have to revisit
that. We'll have to go back and see that. But Ida was a film that made both of our top five. So good stuff. David, though, said Boyhood is the pick. And there are some listeners who have already had a chance to see Boyhood. It's played at various festivals. And this brings us perfectly to this week's poll question. Another one of our film spotting patented death matches. And Josh, I think this is the worst one yet.
Yeah, I was going to say, this is just going to kill you. I mean, it wasn't easy for me, but I found my way to an answer.
Oh, you could answer it.
Yeah. You don't have an answer yet?
I don't know if I have an answer
yet. Still,
I mean,
I guess you've got a little bit of time.
I'm a tremendous waffler. So
this is true. How about I give you my answer and then you just go the other direction?
I like it. That's probably where I'll go anyway. So simply, deathmatch, pick a director. Linklater, that's Richard Linklater, or Soderbergh. Both directors made their feature-length debut in 1989, and you can only vote for one. The other director's entire filmography, it just goes in the dustbin.
Okay.
It's gone forever.
All right, that's what I was going to ask. Does this mean that person is then no longer allowed to make future films also?
No.
Okay.
Their whole collected body of work is gone. No one can ever watch it again.
Past and future.
Yeah.
And is my memory wiped?
We didn't really think it out that far. We'll have to get Sam on the phone and see what he was going for here. Now, Sam, our producer, one of our wonderful producers, does note that Linklater's debut in 89 was a movie called It's Impossible to Learn to Plow by Reading Books, which is available as second disc bonus content on the Criterion edition of Slacker, which was his breakout movie. Mm-hmm. Apparently, you can also see it on YouTube if you're so inclined. Steven Soderbergh's debut in 89, of course, Sex, Lies, and Videotape. An honorable mention for me last week.
Interestingly, did not make either of our top five films of 1989 list.
No, but my number six.
Okay.
So pretty close.
It was in my
and
top 10.
I think round one decidedly goes to Soderbergh there, though if you put Sex, Lies versus Slacker, I'd still go Sex,
tougher.
Lies, but Slacker still a very good film. So we are at the death match, Josh. Are you going to give our audience your choice here?
Yeah, it's a temperature thing for me is how I thought about this, because both filmmakers, I mean, I don't have to talk about how good their output is and how prolific it is. I think that's what's interesting about both of them as well. But Soderbergh, even at his best, is still cool. He's a very clinical, cool director. Sometimes that trips me up on his films. That's where we split very much on last year's Side Effects, is that I felt it was more of an experiment. Linklater is such a warm filmmaker. He has the warmth for his characters, that empathy that we talked about with Gus Van Sant's films that we've been revisiting here and there, that we feel exuding from the screen is so evident in all of Linklater's films, right up through Bernie and very likely through Boyhood, I would imagine. And for me, I'm a Chicago guy. We get 110 degrees and within the same 12 months, we get negative 20. Negative 10 last winter, something like that. I'm much more the guy who'd rather be outside sweating in the heat than freezing in the cold and shivering. So this is how I wrap my mind around it. It's a Linklater.
Wow.
I'm going with the warmth.
So next time we go to a Soderbergh screening, I know you're going to bring your coat.
That's why I'm, I'm bundled up.
Wow. So not surprisingly, you go with Linklater.
What you would have guessed?
Yeah, I would have guessed Linklater totally.
Okay.
I went to Letterboxd where I have ranked both of these directors' filmographies. And I've not seen all of their films. So that's another thing that potentially hurts us weighing in.
Yeah,
here,
I haven't seen
them
all
that
either.
Maybe there are some films that would completely change my mind. But I have seen 13 of Linklater's films. And of course, that doesn't include Boyhood because I haven't had a chance to see it yet. I understand you're seeing it tomorrow.
Tomorrow morning, I'm going to see that.
Great. Steven Soderbergh, I've seen 24 of his films. So Soderbergh has him just in terms of quantity. But in terms of quality, I was comparing their top fives, as we like to do here on the show. My top five Linklater movies. Before Sunset, Before Sunrise, Dazed and Confused, Before Midnight, and this is where I go off and veer away from a lot of other people, my number five, Fast Food Nation.
Okay.
But those four, those first four, you've got the entire Before trilogy in Dazed and Confused. That's tough to beat.
Mm-hmm.
You go to Soderbergh, Out of Sight, Traffic, The Limey, Ocean's 11, and Solaris. I love all five of those films as well. If I was going to combine them into a top 10.
So now you're ranking both.
Ranking
against,
both of those top fives. I'm very methodical. I'm very clinical and cold like Steven Soderbergh about this. Josh.
I know where you're going.
Except,
you need a chart.
The warmth of Linklater comes through because guess what? Four of those top five, if I was combining the list, would be Linklater movies.
Okay.
The only Soderbergh movie that would creep into the top five would be Out of Sight. But I'd have Dazed and Confused and the Before trilogy in there ahead of those other Soderbergh films.
I'm a bit dazed by the math, but I think you've arrived at your answer.
I have. It's Soderbergh. Soderbergh is my answer.
This is why I've hated math.
That's where I'm going. I'm going Soderbergh.
All right.
And I really, truly can't explain it, Josh. So let's just move on.
That's what you want to say.
Yeah.
Maybe that explains it.
I just feel like, honestly, if
you're
we're
in a conversation with a bunch of cinephiles and you want to say you'd go with Soderbergh.
No, because I actually think it would be.
You've given me no other reason.
I think it'd be
even
better
the math
somehow.
Works out the other way.
I think it'd be better somehow to say Linklater for the very reason you gave, that he's so much more empathetic and warm. I just think the body of work. I think the body of work speaks for itself. And the films that are at the bottom of Linklater's filmography don't compare to the films that are at the bottom of Soderbergh's filmography. So maybe he's more top-heavy, but the overall body of work, I'm going Soderbergh.
I'm just thoroughly confused at this point by your process.
I could completely change my mind, though, tomorrow, and I'm glad that
we
don't have to pick.
You could spend a week doing this, couldn't you?
I'm glad we don't have to pick, because clearly I love Richard Linklater's work as well. We actually have two polls going over at filmspotting.net right now, so vote in the death match. Tell us what you think. Leave a comment. Tell us how crazy my reasoning is, if you want, but also weigh in on our next Sacred Cow topic. We are going to be looking at some point at the best films of 1992. So we decided to make it a little bit of a Sacred Cow deathmatch option between Reservoir Dogs, Quentin Tarantino's, of course, debut, or Clint Eastwood's Unforgiven, the best picture winner of that year. And so far, I'm shocked to see that it's kind of neck and neck.
It's close.
I thought Reservoir Dogs would run away with it.
Yeah, me too.
But it's very close right now. Unforgiven just trailing a little bit. And everybody here on the film spotting side, behind the scenes, seems to be pushing for Unforgiven and going so far as our producer, Sam, saying it doesn't really matter if Reservoir Dogs wins, we're still going to do Unforgiven, which I'm not sure how I feel about that.
There will be an ape revolt if we try to do that.
I agree. So if you feel very passionately about not hearing me say another word about Reservoir Dogs, even though I haven't seen it since 1992, well, then you must go to filmspotting.net and vote in that poll. The debut there, Josh, of your theme music, The Larson Recommends theme music. I haven't even shared this with you yet.
Oh, did you use that?
Yeah, you've heard it.
I did hear it, and I didn't get a chance to ask you. I know.
In L.A. It's
so honored.
It's the Film Spotting theme by way of Get Shorty, basically, is what it sounds like. And it transitions us into a segment we do call Larson Recommends, even though we're talking about the movie Tammy. And Josh, I've seen your review of Tammy, and I don't think you're actually recommending it. So why are you lying to our listeners?
No, well, and we also need a less bouncy music than sad music.
True.
Larson Recommends not seeing this, the sad music version. I don't want to give him more work, though. You should see it if you're at all interested, because I'm very much on the line. I don't think it works in the end, but it's not one I would, you know, tell people to stay away from. I've just been fascinated by McCarthy's career and what she's been trying to do, because I think she's been circling around this same character for a couple of films now. Identity Thief, The Heat with Sandra Bullock, and now Tammy. And this is the one where she had the most creative control. She wrote the script with her husband, Ben Falcone, and he directed. So I thought, this is going to be it. This is where she's going to get her hands on what she's been wanting to do. And at first, I was really exhilarated, because rather than back away from this sort of foul-mouthed, aggressive, abrasive character that these other films have had her do, she starts right in the midst of it. Tammy works at a fast food joint, shows up and gets fired very early in the film for arriving, you know, looking really sloppy. And she lets her boss, Falcone, have it. A great line about what she thinks the chicken sandwiches are made of that I can't repeat here. And I thought, well, good. She's embracing this, this character that's very much in the mold of early Adam Sandler or even Jim Carrey, where it's just in your face, aggressive, comic anger, really. And she's very good at that. She's very funny at it. The problem is, both Identity Thief and The Heat eventually found their way towards softening this character in the end and trying to make her a little bit more human. And this is something that, you know, maybe Billy Madison did too.
Right. I was going to say, don't the Sandler movies do that as well?
They always try to get their characters to learn a lesson, right? But do you ever believe that Billy Madison really learned his lesson? I mean, the script may have them saying those words, but you know that they're just winking, or Jim Carrey. And as soon as the credits roll, they're going to be back to who they were. For some reason, McCarthy feels the need to have the lesson learned in her movies. And I think that's admirable in one way, because it's a tougher thing to do. So she's setting herself up for a tougher task than Sandler or Carrey would ever do. And she's also capable of doing it. I mean, I've seen her in straightforward dramatic scenes, and she's a very good actress as well. And independently in Tammy, in those scenes when they come with Susan Sarandon, who plays her grandmother, they go on a road trip together. She attempts it in scenes with Mark Duplass as this romantic interest. Those don't work quite as well. But basically, McCarthy has the dramatic chops. What I never buy is that she's the same person in the same film. So it's a hurdle she sets for herself. I admire the attempt, and it just doesn't work in merging those two disparate characters into one fully functional human being that you can believe.
You knocked over a topper, Jack.
Do you want some pies? You want pies?
Yes, please.
I feel like we're kind of getting somewhere, and under different circumstances, we'd probably be, you know, good pals, like find like a hot tub or...
I actually have one in my apartment complex.
Fingers crossed, we meet up again.
We bust out the new theme music, and yet Josh can't even find it in his heart to recommend the new film starring Melissa McCarthy, Tammy. When we come back, we will bless or perhaps curse Hollywood's up-and-comers by naming the most promising actors of the future. Josh, whatever happened to Armie Hammer anyway?
The Lone Ranger happened to Armie Hammer.
Indeed. The Film Spotting Top 5 is next. Stay with us.
It's not too late to come by my house, even though the sun is coming out, because I'm still up. It's what I do when I'm all
Thank you time here on Film Spotting. First, we do want to mention our music. The Austin, Texas-based Bob Schneider. You heard Unpromised Land and Hop on the World from his 2013 album Burden of Proof. Bob Schneider is a guy who we've played on Film Spotting before, maybe back in 2006 or 7, Josh, because I love his album from 2002. And he's released 5 or 6 since then and has just been off my radar completely. And it was actually listener Grant Mordecai in Austin who recently reminded me of Bob Schneider and recommended him to be featured on the show. Schneider's currently on tour with dates this weekend in New Braunfels and Bryan, Texas. Then he's heading north to Kansas City. He's playing Madison, Minneapolis, and Chicago next weekend. He's playing on the 19th at Park West. I don't think I'm going to make it, which is depressing, Josh, because, again, big fan, and I love both of those songs we played. Bob Schneider, more info at bobschneider.com. Let's get to some donations. We start with Shad in Butler, Pennsylvania, and we have another Pennsylvania listener, Ethan, a gold-level donor in Lancaster, PA, and then 2 new $5 a month subscribers.
That would be Alex in Bloomington, Indiana, and Daniela from Bartlett, Illinois.
And Daniela was mentioned last week on the show. That's when her donation came in, but we didn't get a chance to get to her comments. She did send in a nice note that we'll end with here.
My first big thanks has to be to you guys for being a couple of my best friends following the birth of my daughter. Yes, no irony lost that during a time I was feeling like I would never see a movie again, I spent my time strolling my newborn and listening to reviews about movies I feared I would never see. Although it may now have to be in pieces, I'm able to catch up on some of the movies you've recommended. It sounds like I'm in good company by thanking you for your suggestion on Short Term 12. This movie was able to tell several compelling and difficult stories in a very digestible way, which I'm still not sure I'm okay with. Is it okay to feel warm and fuzzy when you know that most situations such as these don't really end that well? But I felt taken with the characters and am excited to see what Brie Larson will do next.
Daniela goes on, also wanted to point out that Adam and I have so much in common. I love the name Holden, your son. Indeed, my oldest is named Holden. It's the name of the lead character in my favorite movie, Chasing Amy. I also lived in the London area after my husband and I were first married. Although I was quite homesick while there, I think it's a great city that is like a European version of Chicago. You know, we have the Loop, they have the Financial District, we have Michigan Avenue, they have Oxford Street, etc. I dated someone from Iowa for a while. Okay, that's all I can say about Iowa, Daniela writes. Hey, guess what? I dated someone from Iowa, too.
This is true.
For a while. I like movies, Daniela adds. Okay, so that's not a lot. My husband is yelling over my shoulder that he didn't know I dated someone from Iowa.
Uh-oh.
In summary, thanks for all the great movie reviews. Thank you for that great note and for your donation. We thank all of our donors this week, including those monthly donors, whether it's $2, $5, or $10. You guys are the lifeblood of the show. And one other quick note, speaking of Iowa, Josh, I was back there over the weekend for the 4th. My band, rocking out downtown Grinnell.
I heard.
Block party. It was a good time. And over that weekend, it turns out that one of my sisters, Megan, and my mom were in West Des Moines at Babies R Us because my sister Megan has a young one at home, Miles. And they were in the parking lot, I think walking in or maybe walking out. And this has never happened to me yet. I've been wanting this to happen. It happened to my mom and my sister. They see a woman wearing a Film Spotting t-shirt.
Nice.
With her husband. And Megan walks right by her and so says to her, hey, Film Spotting, that's my brother.
Uh-huh.
And she's like, as in Adam Kempinar? And of course, my mom and my sister were just so impressed that someone was wearing our t-shirt and actually knew who I was. And they thought this whole thing was just make-believe.
Did she know you were a rock star too?
I don't know.
They should have
come
that out
and watched
blown
us
her
play.
Mind.
But it was very funny. That was Aaron Perry, a recent Massacre Theater winner. I think that t-shirt was her prize.
Oh, there you go.
She was wearing it out to Babies R Us.
Very nice.
So, we say hello to you, Aaron, and again, thank all of our donors this week.
Your mother hoped you'd never find. Your father tried his best to lie. I know your heart is young and wild and full of fire and fury tonight.
Hey there, Film Spotting Original Recipe listeners. Allison Wilmore here from the Film Spotting Streaming Video Unit podcast. And on the latest episode of SVU, Matt Singer and I cruise around in a van trying to lure unsuspecting victims into our alien meat processing plants. You know, just your usual Sunday night in New York City, while we discuss Jonathan Glazer's Under the Skin.
We'll also be talking about some other movies featuring memorable extraterrestrials that you can rent or stream at home right now. To listen or subscribe to the show, find us in iTunes or at filmspottingsvu.com.
Hi, this is Lynn Shelton, director of Hump Day and Your Sister Sister. You are listening to Film Spotting.
Sometimes I wonder if maybe I couldn't have taken better care of you.
The past doesn't matter.
It does matter.
Well, I took care of myself.
I know you did, but sometimes I think I could have done more.
Stop.
You really never think about it?
No.
You're not angry with me?
I know you don't think much of me, but I knew what I was doing then, and I still do.
No, Martha, I think the world of you. Sometimes I just think I should have come home and made sure you went to college. You had so much potential.
You know, I don't need your guidance now, and I didn't then. I am a teacher and a leader. You just never let me be that, but now I am. I know who I am.
Your 2012 actor of the future, Elizabeth Olsen, in that scene from director Sean Durkin's Martha, Marcy, May, Marlene, back in April 2012.
Back in the good old days.
The good old days. We did name our top five up-and-coming actors, a list we return to for this week's top five. We have only done this list, actually, twice in the show's history, first back in 2008 with Maddie Ballgame, and then we did it in 2012. Back in 2008, we had a much more catchy name, though. Actors of the future, and that's what we're going with.
We're
this
returning
time.
To actors.
Yeah, we're
going to
return
future.
To that. It just sounds so much more dramatic.
Sounds like that needs some theme music.
There's some gravitas to actors of the future. This is a list, though. All jokes aside, we were intending to do on an annual basis to sort of take stock of some of the young actors that are out there, kind of anoint them, maybe try to get a few more eyeballs on their work. And obviously, we didn't do it last year. We thought we would give it a shot this year. Elizabeth Olsen, she was your number two pick in 2012. I called mine the Elizabeth Olsen Memorial List. So
right.
We both gave her some love. And since then, you know, the Old Boy remake didn't go so well. Josh Radnor's liberal arts didn't get much attention or acclaim. But she was in Godzilla this year. She's coming out in, of course, 2015's Avengers. I think her career is very much headed in the right direction. She's got a bright future still.
She should probably start picking some different projects.
Maybe.
I mean, was Elizabeth Olsen the reason Godzilla was good?
No.
And if the next Avengers is good, do you think it's going to be because of Elizabeth Olsen?
No.
I mean, none of these are really allowing her to do what we've seen she can do really well.
No, that's a good point. As far as my 2012 list, though, I don't want to pat myself on the back too hard, Josh, but...
Get it over with.
Yeah, I'm going to get it over with. I put out on the Twitter to our listeners, in anticipation of this list, tell us your actors of the future. Basically, we're looking at people. These are not hard and fast rules, just sort of basic guidelines for people to consider. You know, under 30, maybe even younger than that, under 28, and only a few feature credits to their name. Maybe they've done some TV work, but they're still relatively unknowns, and yet you are really enamored with their work and want to see more of them. I threw that out there, and... 90% of the responses I saw were my choices from 2012. So
what does that
people
tell you?
Need to study our top five page more, maybe. Just kidding, of course. Or what it means is I was way on to these people 2 years before everybody else. I actually
who
did
were those
well.
People, Adam?
Well, I had Miles Teller. This is before his breakout performance in The Spectacular Now. I had Brie Larson before her breakout performance in Short Term 12. Carrie Bechet, probably the one who's least familiar to listeners, but she was just in something fairly big that I'm drawing a blank on. We'll try to look that up during the show here. Dane DeHaan, a lot of people love him. He was in The Amazing Spider-Man 2, I want to say. Josh, I didn't see that film, but I believe he was one
it.
Of the villains. And Britt Marling was my number one. She really hasn't done anything I would point to. I brought up The East a few episodes back, but she is in a new film coming out called I, Origins, which she worked on with Mike Cahill, who was her collaborator on Another Earth a few years ago. So definitely some great stuff I think we're going to see from her. Even if I, Origins doesn't pan out, I think she's got a great future ahead of her. So I did okay with that Elizabeth Olsen Memorial list.
My list might be yours, though.
Yeah, but that's because you picked a bunch of too established people.
Oh, come
on. I'm just going to say it.
No. Okay,
those names are too familiar.
I had Armie Hammer, Elizabeth Olsen, yes.
Right.
But I also had Greta Gerwig, Oscar Isaac, Chris Pratt.
Chris Pratt, I'll give you. But Gerwig and Oscar Isaac, I think, were too established.
No way. No one knew who Oscar Isaac was. Before Inside Llewyn Davis? No.
Okay.
Gerwig?
Okay.
Noah Baumbach knew who she was.
Anyone who watches those quote-unquote mumblecore movies knows who Greta Gerwig was from the Joe Swanberg film. So, I don't know. She seemed too familiar to me. Had some breakout roles already. But Frances Ha was her big coming out party, I think, Josh. That's
and
fair to
say.
And this
was pre-Frances Ha?
Yes, it was.
Okay.
Because I think that was 2013.
Right.
Or was it,
line
with Frances Ha? 2012?
No, Frances Ha was last year.
Okay. We will move on to our top five.
I think.
Actors of
as
the
I
future.
Look that up.
We'll see who has too many established names on their list this time, or whether we will surprise you with some names you may learn about more down the road. Josh, you're number five.
My number five is, after I confirmed that Francis Ha was 2013, and it was, thank you. My number five is Evan Peters. And consider this another apology for not mentioning Peters when Michael Phillips and I reviewed X-Men Days of Future Past. We should have spent more time on him because he was a bright spot in that film for sure. This is a bit of a blind pick for me because I've only seen him in Days of Future Past, but he was the liveliest thing in that film. He only had a couple of scenes from what I recall, and one of them, the first, is when Professor X, Wolverine, and Beast track him down in his parents' basement to ask for his help in breaking into the Pentagon. They need his mutant power, his super fast speed.
You guys want? I didn't do anything.
I've been here all day.
Just relax, Peter. We're not cops.
No, you're not cops. Hey, what's with this gift to Youngster's place?
That's an old card.
What, a teleporter?
No, he says fast. And when I know him, he wasn't so young.
Young? You're just old. So who are you? What do you want?
We need your help, Peter.
What?
Break into a highly secured facility.
Prison break? So what's in it for me?
You get to break into the Pentagon.
How do I know I can trust you?
I think it's notable that in this scene, he's paired with James McAvoy and Hugh Jackman, two fairly charismatic performers, if very different, mm-hmm. I would say. And yet Peters manages to make his mark as this sort of aloof teen who recognizes his gifts but is pretty much using them to shoplift and the like. And this is a movie that's just overstuffed with mutants. Remember, I couldn't even get the gender of one of them right
yes.
at one point when you were talking about it. Yet Peters stands out among all of them and really does make a mark there. So he is going to be back as Quicksilver in 2016's X-Men Apocalypse.
He is.
At this point, that's what IMDb tells me. And that's probably the only reason I have to look forward to it. Apologies all around to X-Men fans for a lot of that.
A great pick. My number five actor of the future is Caitlin Dever. And listeners may know her from the series Justified, which I have failed to catch up with, unfortunately. Some other TV work. She's had appearances on Modern Family and Curb Your Enthusiasm. But it was her 2013 releases that we talked about last year, and I don't think we brought her up specifically by name anyway, and we probably should have, because we were too busy singing the praises of Brie Larson in Short Term 12 and Miles Teller and Shailene Woodley in The Spectacular Now. But she was in both of those movies as well. She's a 21-year-old actress. She played Crystal, Woodley's best friend, in The Spectacular Now, and she's very good there. But where she really stood out was her performance in Short Term 12 as Jaden. She develops a bond with the main character that Larson plays named Grace. She comes to this group home, to this facility, to get some care, and she is a little bit of this rebellious teenager. She definitely doesn't intend to be there any longer than she has to. She thinks her dad is going to come get her on her birthday, and they'll eventually let her out of here. And there's a really wonderful scene in the movie, really harrowing scene, where she reads a story that she's written and drawn the illustrations for to the Brie Larson character about the octopus and the shark.
Once upon a time, somewhere miles and miles beneath the surface of the ocean, there lived a young octopus named Nina. Nina spent most of her time alone, making strange creations out of rocks and shells. She was very happy. But then on Monday, the shark showed up. "What's your name?" said the shark. "Nina," she replied. "Do you want to be my friend?" he asked. "Okay, what do I have to do?" said Nina. "Not much," said the shark. "Just let me eat one of your arms." Nina had never had a friend before, so she wondered if this is what you had to do to get one.
There's real maturity in this performance, very restrained performance. If you watch that scene, she really betrays nothing in it. She just shares her story, which makes sense because the character isn't someone who we would believe to be begging for help or asking for help. That story may or may not be a cry for help. That's how the Grace character perceives it. But that character, Jaden, doesn't see herself that way. She's just sharing this story. And I think she just really could have overplayed that Jaden character in terms of being more self-destructive, more angry, and more in pain. maybe made her more of a punk kid who you find obnoxious, but you really feel a lot of empathy for her. And I think, as I said, just a really mature performance from a young actress at 21 in Caitlin Dever. Her next projects include Men, Women, and Children for director Jason Reitman. She's got Grass Stains coming out with Ty Sheridan, a very talented young actor who we've talked about quite a bit. And she's filming The Greens Are Gone with a whole host of really talented comedic performers, including Maya Rudolph, Molly Shannon, and Catherine Keener.
Yeah, Short Term 12 and The Spectacular Now, both in 2013. That's not a bad year for Dever, definitely. My number four is Sarah Gadon. And this is a Canadian actress who's been appearing here and there in bit parts for a while now, but there were two recent supporting roles that are really what caught my attention. The first was in 2012's Cosmopolis from director David Cronenberg. She played the wife of Robert Pattinson's mysterious billionaire, and she shows up periodically on his Odyssey for these cryptic conversation scenes between them.
Where was your necktie?
Had my checkup. Saw my heart on the screen.
I don't like saying this.
But
you smell of sex.
That's my doctor's appointment. You smell.
I smell sex all over you.
Interestingly, in 2012, Gadon also had a part in Antiviral, which is from director Brandon Cronenberg, mm-hmm. David Cronenberg's son. And she's now another reason I want to catch up with that. This year, though, Gadon was in Enemy. That's the Jake Gyllenhaal psychological thriller, which didn't really work for me overall, but her cool, reserved presence was a bright spot in the film, I thought. She was the pregnant wife of the actor played by Gyllenhaal. It's a dual role for him. You're not quite sure what's real or who is who throughout Enemy. And Gadon has the right aura of mystery for that sort of milieu. You sense that both here mm-hmm. and in Cosmopolis. Coming up, she's going to reteam along with Pattinson on Cronenberg's Maps to the Stars that played at Cannes, but still waiting for a U.S. release date on that for Sarah Gadon.
My number four choice, well, it's your number five, Josh. I also went with Evan Peters, mainly from X-Men Days of Future Past, that performance as Quicksilver. If you're not familiar with him as an actor, you haven't seen that movie, maybe. I would describe Evan Peters as a more buff Michael Cera. He looks like a little bit of a hunkier Michael Cera to me. And I do remember him vaguely as one of Aaron Johnson's two best friends in Kick-Ass. That was where I saw him for
yes,
the first time.
Yeah.
But his coming out was this superhero movie, X-Men, from this year. He did. He stole the movie. I'm on record as saying that. Not just the set piece of the time in a bottle sequence, which is just great stuff, but the introductory scene that you talked about, his comedic timing is just so strong. He's holding his own with Hugh Jackman and James McAvoy, two phenomenally talented actors. Nicholas Holt, also younger, but a very good actor in that scene. And it does make me feel good to know that we're going to see him ostensibly more in X-Men down the road in 2016, but I think a lot of people, after seeing X-Men Days of Future Past, were watching that film and going, really? We have to watch Aaron Johnson as Quicksilver in this other line mm-hmm, of movies
right.
that was teased, along with Elizabeth Olsen, in the end credits for Captain America 2. Evan Peters is just so much of a better actor, just based on what I've seen so far, than Aaron Johnson, that I would much rather see him as Quicksilver. But I guess we're going to see both of them.
Yeah, I think I would rather see the feature being given to Peters for sure. My number three is Sarah Baker, who has been around since the early 2000s, mostly doing TV, though her first screen credit was a bit part in Reese Witherspoon's Sweet Home Alabama. I first became aware of her in the 2012 Will Ferrell comedy, The Campaign. Did you say something about Will Ferrell comedies?
I did.
There she played the wife of Zach Galifianakis's puppet candidate. And she gets a rather memorable love scene with Ferrell. And she's also part of a hysterical dinner confessional scene, neither of which we can provide clips for on the radio. Most people will probably recognize Baker, though, from the Louis C.K. clip that went viral earlier this year, in which she and Louis have a frank conversation about what it's like to go on dates, in her character's words, as a fat girl.
Well, you're not. I mean,
don't.
You're not fat.
Ah, oh, damn it. That is so goddamn disappointing, Louis.
You're not. You're not. I mean,
Louis. Do you know what the meanest thing is you can say to a fat girl? You're not fat. I mean, come on, buddy.
I'm sorry.
It just sucks. Oh, it really, really sucks. You have no idea. And the worst part is, I'm not even supposed to do this.
Do what?
tell anyone how bad it sucks, because it's too much for people. I mean, you can talk into the microphone and say you can't get a date, you're overweight, and it's adorable. But if I say it, they call the suicide hotline on me.
That Louie episode showed off her dramatic skills, which are considerable. But now she's getting more attention at the moment for a broadly comedic part in Tammy. Atlantic's The Wire called it the second scene-stealing role of the year, and she plays a fast food cashier who gets robbed by Melissa McCarthy. So over the course of these couple of performances, you can see that she's got range. She's getting some high-profile chances to show it. So Sarah Baker, my number three actor.
Yeah, I haven't seen Tammy yet, but I know exactly who you're talking about, and she is very good every time I've seen her on screen. I should note one of my criteria when forming this list, it's the same one I applied in 2012. I didn't want to pick people who I'd only seen in one thing, because it's just not enough of a track record to go on, and also it can have some overlap with a list we did last year, and we tend to highlight on this show at the end of the year. We like to point out discoveries, people right. who were brand new to us. I didn't want to find people who were brand new, and they just had that one to go on. I wanted a little bit of a track record to base my appreciation on, and my number three, Tavi Gevinson, that's the only one where that doesn't really apply, because she was in a short film, a 7-minute 2D animated film called Cadaver, but otherwise I've only seen her in one feature film, Josh, and that is Enough Said from last year. Gevinson is an 18-year-old actress. She just graduated from high school right here in Oak Park, Illinois. She's done a voice on The Simpsons, and she was in an episode of the new TV series Parenthood, but this was her first screen credit. I think we're going to see a lot more from her. She is the best friend of the daughter of
Okay,
Julia
that's what
Louis
I was
going to
ask, if she's the daughter or
yeah,
the best friend.
Her name's Chloe, and she clearly is not getting enough attention from her mother at home, and maybe not enough from her friend, the daughter to our lead, Eva, because she is looking for some kind of guidance, some kind of mentoring, someone she can open up to and get some advice from. And she's just always kind of hanging out at Eva's house. And I think we've all known a girl kind of like her, or had a friend in our past kind of like that, who just ends up hanging out at your house an awful lot for whatever reason. And she is there all the time, even when her friend isn't there. And she develops this kind of surrogate mother-daughter relationship with the Julia Louis-Dreyfus character. I just think it really could have been a throwaway part, totally forgettable. It's not a character who's really in some ways crucial to the plot, but she does reinforce some of the changes. She matches up in some ways with what the Dreyfus character is going through, and the sense of losing her daughter and trying to connect with someone. But Chloe just could have been someone not only forgettable, but someone more ditzy and more annoying and a little bit more lost. And the way Gevinson plays her is just as a teenager.
What are you guys talking about?
Nothing. I can't decide if I should sleep with Chris or not. Oh. I don't want to do something I'll regret, but I also happen to really like him, and I don't know what to do.
And you're a virgin, right?
Well, don't yes. answer that.
Some people may know Gevinson out there. I wasn't familiar with this until very recently, but she's actually been in the public sphere since the time she was like 11. She started her own fashion blog. She's the founder and editor-in-chief of the online magazine Rookie that's aimed at teenage girls. And if you look at Forbes' 30 Under 30 in Media list, she made it in 2011 and 2012. So she's an 18-year-old media mogul who also happens to be a really talented young actress. And I see her as an Elizabeth Olsen type who could play a variety of roles. She's very smart. She comes off as very smart, but also there's a mystery about her where she just seems like someone who, whatever character she plays, is not going to be an open book. There's always going to be some layers there. I am very excited, Josh, to say that I'm going to see her on the stage very soon, because I have tickets the night before our live show. I should be preparing. Instead, I'm going to be going to Steppenwolf here in Chicago to see Gevinson on stage with Kieran Culkin and Michael Cera in the Kenneth Lonergan play, This Is Our Youth.
Very nice.
So we'll
know who to blame if you're not prepared.
There you go. We'll see what Tavi Gevinson's chops are like on the stage. She's my number three.
That's a good pick. She has some really strong scenes with Dreyfus and Enough Said. My number two is Ty Sheridan. You mentioned him, and he's certainly not a new name to Film Spotting listeners. Adam, you interviewed him about the David Gordon Green film Joe this year. But despite working on three fantastic pictures already, he's still in the up-and-coming stage of his career. His debut was in Terrence Malick's Tree of Life, and what a blessing and a curse to start your career that way. Not likely he's going to top that, I would say. He played one of the three young brothers, and like all of them, he had this astonishing natural presence. Sheridan had a bit more to do in Jeff Nichols' Mud from 2012. He plays a boy who's growing up on a houseboat on a river who becomes disenchanted with his parents and falls in with a potentially dangerous stranger played by Matthew McConaughey. Now, in Joe, alongside Nicolas Cage, we saw a notably older Sheridan. There was quite a physical difference. But there was also, he was older in his acting style, too. I think he was much more aware of himself, playing this son of an abusive drifter who finds work with Cage's character. It's a good performance, a lot of good performances in that film. But I think you could see Sheridan's effort and his craft starting to creep in a little bit. Didn't have that innocence that child performances sometimes can have, where they have no real knowledge of the camera. At least it feels mm-hmm. that way. So it'll be interesting to see where he'll take what he's beginning to learn. And it could be to some pretty great places. He's certainly going to be busy. Looked on IMDb, and he's got 6 feature projects lined up there. Wow. So.
Well, I almost suggested him as our memorial list pick because I know we're both big fans of his work. Definitely someone I considered very strongly. My number 2 is a comedic actor. At least that's all I know him from, and he just seems to have a knack for it. I don't know if he's much of a dramatic actor or not, but his name's Josh Brenner. He's been on a couple episodes of The Big Bang Theory. There's a lot of assorted TV credits there. He was in the movie The Internship with Owen Wilson and Vince Vaughn. I didn't see that movie, but I took notice of him on the IFC series Maron, Mark Maron's TV show, of course. Mm-hmm. I listen religiously to the WTF podcast, and Josh Brenner plays Kyle, who is basically Maron's assistant. He just shows up as a guy who's a fan and wants to get into comedy and basically just doesn't let Mark kick him out of the house because he's going to help him. He's going to work for him. And they do develop this kind of love-hate relationship. You'll often see Brenner in scenes trying to take control of the action and prove how useful he is and how smart he is, and he's always just so damn proud of himself.
What are we looking for exactly?
I'm not sure, all right? I'll know it when I see it.
Is it this?
No, just relax. Chill out.
Okay. Can I help you guys with anything?
No.
Yes,
we're good.
Please. We are trying to retrieve a dead possum from a crawl space. You know what a crawl space is, right?
Yeah, they're pretty common.
Oh, perfect. Then you know what we're talking about. So what do you think we'll need in the way of tools and or retrieval equipment? We were thinking a dead animal grabber.
You know what? We're fine. We're just going to look around. It's no big deal.
If you're going under the house, you're definitely going to want some gloves and coveralls.
Yes, nailed it.
The thing I really love about him on Maron is that he is just indomitable. There's a spirit about Brenner that will not be brought down, which sucks for Mark when he's trying to take out some frustration on him and just trying to crush him, frankly. Their chemistry really makes for some good television. From that first episode when he was introduced, I just wanted to see him in every scene. I wanted him to keep recurring as a character. Unfortunately, he has in many more episodes. But even if I wasn't getting enough of a kick of Brenner there from Maron, he was cast in the new Mike Judge show that just ended its first season on HBO, Silicon Valley. He plays a character named Big Head, and he's a similar sort of lost punch him and he just keeps coming back type of character, but without the overconfident act. Probably in terms of overall stardom, if I'm going to look in my crystal ball and try to predict future success, he's probably the least likely of any of the candidates on my list to have a huge career. But there is a Jason Segel, Seth Rogen type of quality to him that, who knows, if he gets in with the right people, the right ensemble, he really could be something.
Yeah, and sometimes isn't it also a matter of getting to do what they do well
right.
on a larger stage with better material?
Yeah.
It may not be becoming a matinee idol, but getting a larger stage to do their work.
Yeah, and if you look at his IMDb page, he's got 3 or 4 projects in the works. They're all smaller indie projects, though, so that's just it. Maybe he isn't quite getting that stage yet to play on, but maybe quality-wise, they will be projects that really do give him a chance to show what he can do.
My number one might become a star, though, I'll say. Adam Driver.
Yeah.
And fans of HBO's Girls, they knew about him from that series, which premiered in 2012. I first made note of him from Francis Ha, even though I'd seen him in bit parts in Lincoln and J. Edgar beforehand. In Francis Ha, he had this lanky charm as one of the occasionally ambitious aspiring artists who made up Greta Gerwig's circle of New York City friends. And then last year, he showed up in the Coen Brothers Inside Llewyn Davis and stole his scenes as Al Cody, the baritone behind the novelty song, Please, Mr. Kennedy.
red, red, and white.
Powder.
With a healthy libido.
Space.
You lose her vote.
Powder.
If you make her a widow.
Space.
Who'll play catch out in the back with our kid? No, please, Mr. Kennedy.
Uh-oh.
I don't want to go.
Please don't shoot me into outer space.
Countdown.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2.
Oh, no.
Oh, please, Mr. Kennedy.
Next up for Driver is Star Wars Episode 7, where he'll interestingly reteam with Llewyn Davis himself and my 2012 up-and-coming actor pick, Oscar Isaac. Now, Star Wars isn't necessarily the place for talented actors to do their best work. I'm thinking of Hayden Christensen particularly, but who knows? That could change a little bit with the franchise now in the hands of the likes of J.J. Abrams and Rian Johnson. You never know. Certainly, Abrams, I think, gave his actors a little more to do in his version of the Star Trek films than the earlier Star Trek films. Beyond Star Wars, Driver has five other upcoming projects. So if any of those strike, I think I'll look pretty good putting him at number one.
Yeah, Driver's definitely a really good pick. My number one, also another comedic actor. His name's Zach Woods, and he was in the recent movie In the Loop. Very funny film, though I don't remember him in that film at all. He was in The Other Guys, which is a movie I know you like, Josh, which I didn't see.
Another
Will Ferrell movie with Mark Wahlberg. He was in a few episodes of The Office, and he was also, I do remember him, in Damsels in Distress, the Whit Stillman film with Greta Gerwig. But this year, he was in a few episodes playing an NSA worker on the show my wife and I do enjoy watching quite a bit on Sunday nights, usually, and that is The Good Wife. He's also in a few episodes of Veep with Julia Louis-Dreyfus, and The Real Vehicle, where I noticed him, the one where he just had to be my number one, was because of his performance in Silicon Valley, going back to the Mike Judge series on HBO. He plays this really buttoned-down, overachieving assistant to a Silicon Valley mogul, if I'm remembering the early episodes correctly, who decides to leave his job to go to work for this startup called Pied Piper. And that's the group of characters, including Josh Brenner, who are trying to make something of this big idea that the lead character has. And despite his always great intentions, he just always seems to be on the outside looking in of whatever it is. He was my favorite Silicon Valley character all season, Josh. But the reason he was number one on my list is because he made me laugh harder in one scene than I've laughed at anything all year long. And I don't know that I'll laugh at anything harder than
movies and TV.
Movies and TV. It's that funny. And now that I've, of course, overhyped it, everyone listening can sit there and think I'm an idiot and not see any of the humor at all. It, of course, would help to watch it. And we will link to this in the show notes if you want to check it out. But the fact is, I'm sorry, the audio alone is gold. Everything that's brilliant about Zach Woods' performance comes through. And just a little bit of setup before I play it. Pied Piper is at this big TechCrunch event where they're supposed to unveil their product. And they've just seen another group basically unveil their product, but better. And he's just gotten done explaining to the guys, it's okay. Every successful business launched is one thing, and then they pivoted to something else. And they look at him like he's crazy. What's wrong with him? And he does say, I'll admit I'm sleep challenged. I just spent 4 days trapped in a steel box out on an oil rig full of robot forklifts. And the thing about this show, Josh, is that's true. He really did do that. But he says, I'm going to go do some market research. I'm going to generate some ideas so we can pivot our business. We're going to find the next big thing our business is going to evolve into. And I just want you to listen to the increasing desperation and darkness in both the content and his tone, in his manner of speaking.
You've heard the phrase, time to pay the piper, right? What if there was an app called Pied Piper that could tell you to a statistical degree of certainty whether you were going to heaven or hell? Very interested, somewhat interested, not interested. Which one? Which one? Which one? How much would it be worth to you if I told you I had a GPS app called Pied Piper tracking the location of your child? I can follow your child anywhere, and there is nothing you can do to stop me. Most missing children are never found. Interested, very interested, or very interested.
I can follow your child anywhere. Which one? Which one? Which one? Every time he said which one, I lost it. He's so earnest. He so means every word he's saying in the moment. It's genius writing, probably with some genius improv going on as well. You never know. But genius in the performance by Zach Woods, my number one. And to help make my pick, Josh, after saying all of that about Mr. Woods, I decided we still needed a little bit of help. I needed more of an authority
mm-hmm.
to help explain my number one pick and really the love for two Silicon Valley characters in my top two slots. So I went to Kumail Nanjiani, who hopefully many of our listeners are familiar with. He is on the show Silicon Valley. He's a very popular now and deservedly so stand-up comedian. He's also got an X-Files podcast out there if some of our followers are listening to that show. And because he has acted with Zach Woods, obviously, quite a bit, I asked him to share his thoughts via audio about what it's like working with Zach and also Josh.
Here's what I think of Zach Woods. His brain just moves faster than everyone else's, so I think it's kind of cheating. Like, he'll say something and you realize that he's already five steps ahead of you. One of the things I remember was we were doing this improv on the show, and there's a part where he thinks I'm the one who has green card issues, and it's actually Martin's character, Guilfoyle, who does. So at the end of the scene, we were improvising, and I said, what is it about me that makes you think I would be the one with visa issues? I'm trying to entrap him. I'm like, is it because I'm Pakistani? And he said, literally with no pause, he said, no, I love Pakistanis. A couple of my foster parents were Pakistani. And that's what I love about Zach Woods, is that he can improvise and come up with something that's hilarious, but also implies so much backstory. And it was so quick. He just painted this picture of this guy who had this very sad life and has now sort of risen above it and done really well for himself. And, you know, what helped him was that a couple of Pakistani families took him in. So I thought that was incredibly hilarious.
What a great bit of insight there from Kumail about improvising with him and that intelligence that he brings to these roles and just his smarts when it comes to being able to come up with something that clever on the spot that doesn't just make you laugh, but actually does say something about his character. He does that in scene after scene. So thank you, Kumail, for your assistance there. Great stuff. And if you're looking for more from Zach Woods, obviously be paying attention to HBO and the next season of Silicon Valley. But in 2015, he's coming out in a movie called Spy that I believe is in post-production already, directed by Paul Feig, who did Bridesmaids.
Nice.
It stars Melissa McCarthy and Rose Byrne, both of Bridesmaids fame. And I know this is the only logical choice to go in a movie directed by Paul Feig, starring Melissa McCarthy and Rose Byrne, Jason Statham.
That's going to be one heck of a fight scene.
I think it will be. So there you go. My number one, Zach Woods. And those are our top five actors of the future, Josh. What about any honorable mentions?
I have one.
Okay.
Some people suggested John Boyega, who
yeah.
I considered because he was so crucial to what made Attack the Block mm-hmm. more than just an alien invasion movie. But that's pretty much all he's done. Until he also will be in Star Wars Episode 7.
That's
so
right.
That's going to be very interesting.
Definitely considered him as well, but only seen him in that one project, Attack the Block. Others I really strongly considered. Imogen Poots, who is a popular choice on Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
She's really good in a not-so-good movie, The Look of Love, starring Steve Coogan. It's a Michael Winterbottom film. Speaking of not very good films that she's good in, Greetings from Tim Buckley. I also considered Anna Lee Tipton. You'll know her as the young babysitter who's in love with Steve Carell in Crazy Stupid Love, but she's also the main character, really, who befriends Greta Gerwig in Damsels in Distress. Ezra Miller. We didn't love talking about Kevin so much.
That's
and
right.
That performance, but he's really good in The Perks of Being a Wallflower and in a completely opposite type of performance earlier in the movie After School. I also thought about Rami Malek. We talked about him a little bit during our short-term 12 discussion last year. He's in The Master. He's the young man who's dating the daughter of Philip Seymour Hoffman's Lancaster Dodd character. And finally, just to prove that it really isn't about necessarily being in your 20s, you can be a breakout performer or someone whose career really kind of takes off later in life. Dagmara Domincic.
Yep.
I'm going with Domincic, Josh. I don't know how close I am, but she's in The Immigrant as one of the prostitutes.
So good.
So good.
Maybe three scenes.
Yeah, maybe two or three scenes, but you're right. Totally memorable. And then speaking of really memorable scenes and not very many of them, she's in the Vera Farmiga film directed by Vera and also starring her called Higher Ground.
Yeah,
that
that's
we
where
did
I
talk
first
about
saw
a few
her.
Years ago. She plays this very earthy, sensual, yet woman of God who is Vera Farmiga's best friend, and she's so good, and I'm glad that I put together that she was in The Immigrant because she's someone I'd like to see other performances from. please send us your picks or any other comments about the show to feedback@filmspotting.net.
You can also leave us a voicemail, 312-264-0744, or find us on Twitter, @FilmSpotting, that's Adam, and @LarsonOnFilm, that's me. You can also follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/FilmSpotting.
Opening and wide release this weekend, the movie we reviewed earlier in the show, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, highly recommended by both of us. Next week on the show, we'll discuss Bong Joon-ho's Snowpiercer with Tilda Swinton and Chris Evans. It's currently playing at the Music Box here in Chicago. I believe it's out in select cities as well. Plus, we'll share our top five magic realism movie moments. It's a tie-in with Michel Gondry's new film, Mood Indigo, which was among your most anticipated summer movies. And you've seen it already. I'm hoping to see it before next week's show. But either way, we're going to go with that top five magical realism moments.
And as a hint to where I'll fall, we'll probably get a chance to use that Larson Recommends theme music we got from Matt Peterson if you're not able to see it and can't weigh in.
Fair enough.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths and to the listeners of the Film Spotting Advisory Board. And special thanks to everyone at Chicago Public Media. Chicago Public Media creates award-winning content about the issues that affect our community, our nation, and our world. More information is available at chicagopublicmedia.org. Our music this week is from Bob Schneider and his album Burden of Proof. More information is at bobschneider.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
They showed up like really hardcore, like, you know, challenging my knowledge of law and how long I'd lived in Illinois and said, he's like, you know, this is illegal, right? And first of all, they yell out for the resident. You know, there's like 25 people sitting in the front lawn.
Yeah.
Where's the resident? So even though I didn't buy the fireworks, I had to go up there. And he was pretty hardcore about it. He said, you know, this is illegal. And I was like, kind of mumbled. And he's like, how long have you lived in Illinois? And gave me that. And then he says, they must do this all the time because he had a routine. He says, let me see your license. Show him the license. He's like, I'm going to drive around the block. I'll be back in 30 seconds. If you've got this cleaned up, you'll get your license back. Otherwise, I'm writing you a ticket.
That's awesome.
So ran to get the broom. I'm hustling.
Uh-huh.
It was not 30 seconds. He was back quicker.
Really?
But it was clean. So then he was really like nice and apologetic. He's like, I know you're just trying to have fun.
Yeah.
And honestly, this was the first year I like actually lit them.
Okay.
Like previous years, other people brought them and I was like, right. Oh, have at it, whatever. But it was just my brother-in-law and me. And it's a pretty dumb thing to do.